From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Historian Harlow Giles Unger returns this week. He's written many books on American history and biographies of our founding fathers. His books are never dry and always a lot of fun. His latest is Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. Harlow Giles Unger, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much. I think you'll find that my newest book, Mr. President, is far from dry because George Washington loved Madeira wines and drank them all the time.
Well, and I say your books are fun, and I really do find them vastly entertaining, which I guess a lot of people might think, you know, because it's so far back in history. You know, we think of the presidents, you know, I mean, certain presidents like, you know, Theodore Roosevelt or President Lincoln even, that seem so modern. We've seen pictures of them or we've seen them depicted in the movies so vividly. But Washington, he's kind of an enigma.
Yes, indeed. And one of the problems that the Founding Fathers had is they were very exciting people. After all, they led a revolution against the world's most powerful, best-trained, best-equipped army and defeated them. These were exciting people, George Washington, Patrick Henry, and Lafayette and the rest. The problem is that most historians are not writers, just as most writers are not historians. So we get distortions in the press where you have wonderful writing, but terrible historic inaccuracies. And you get accuracies in history books, but very, very dry writing. And it's rare that a historian has writing skills.
Well, you certainly do, and you've written so many books. In fact, while we're talking now, I know that you're finishing a book. Before the end of this conversation, you'll have your next book finished. You're writing about, I don't know, maybe I might be exaggerating, but I know you've written quite a few books. This is, what, number 20?
22. actually, I just sent off to press today the book coming out next fall on John Marshall and the creation of the Supreme Court.
Oh, fantastic.
Again, a very exciting book, and certainly Mr. President and George Washington, the Making of the Nation's Highest Office, is truly one of the most exciting books I've worked on because, you know, most people think that George Washington's career ended as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army and his victory at Yorktown and the end success in gaining American independence, but he was our first president, served 8 years, and these were 8 crisis-filled years in which he started with almost no powers. Constitution gave the president almost no powers. It created a figurehead as president. And purposely so. The framers of the Constitution had lived for years under an absolute monarch, King George III of England. They were not about to put George Washington in the presidency and create a George IV. So they absolutely stripped the president of all powers and gave all the powers to the people. That's why the Constitution begins, "We the people of the United States." Those powers were concentrated in the House of Representatives, led by the Speaker of the House, which was the House of Representatives, the only governmental body in the new central government that was directly elected by the people. The Senate at the time was not elected by the people. It was the two senators from each state were appointed by state legislators. And the president, of course, was elected by the Electoral College, whose members, again, were appointed by state legislatures. So the president had almost no powers, as James Madison, who helped write the Constitution, explained that in our government, and these are Madison's words, in our government, the executive department is not the stronger branch of the system, but the weaker. Well, that was fine until the first Congress adjourned in the fall of 1789, leaving George Washington alone in New York, the temporary capital, to try to run a government with no powers to do so. And at the time, it was very, very difficult to call Congress back into session. They lived far off across dirt roads and trails. It took them weeks to get to the Capitol. So here was George Washington alone as president with no powers and facing his first crisis right after Congress adjourned. They had left him no money. They had no money. There were no taxes in those days. And they left him no money to run the government. So, in effect, they forced a government shutdown, if you can imagine Congress ever doing such a thing.
How could that ever happen?
I don't know. I mean, thank goodness it would never happen. Our Congress today would never do
that. Never. They would never stoop so low. Well, let me just ask you before we continue there. Even before that, I was kind of surprised in your book to discover that the Constitution itself was kind of a second revolution.
It was indeed. After independence from Britain, each of the former 13 colonies became independent states, sovereign states, just like the countries in Europe. There were no ties between them at all. It was a confederation. With a Confederation Congress, which served simply as a forum for representatives from all the 13 states to get together every once in a while and talk about mutual problems. But it had no powers. It couldn't raise a common defense against a common enemy. It couldn't raise taxes. It had absolutely no powers at all. And just as Europe did for centuries, the newly independent American states fell apart and started fighting and squabbling with each other, first over territorial claims. New York and Massachusetts went to war, claiming the same territories in what is now southern Vermont.
Did they actually go to a shooting war?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Some farmers from Connecticut went and tried to settle vacant lands in northeastern Pennsylvania. And the Pennsylvania sent its militia to fire on them and killed several of them. And Connecticut sent troops over to Pennsylvania to try to protect them. So there were really shootouts, and there would have been really widespread wars had the states been a little bit more powerful. But they were pretty well weakened by the Revolution. They had very little money, and there was very little eagerness on the part of militiamen to go back to war. They had fought for 8 years and they were tired of it. But Virginia and Maryland almost had a shooting war over claims to navigation rights on the Potomac River, which they both shared. Now, Maryland claimed that its border was on the Virginia side of the Potomac, and Virginia claimed that its border was on the Maryland side of the border. Mm. Both of them wanted to collect duties from ships sailing up and down the river, and they almost went to war, and Washington called representatives of the two states to gather at his home in Mount Vernon and talk this out, and he convinced them that they could make much more money by combining their operations, forming a what we would today call a common economic union. And they suddenly saw the light, did exactly that, and indeed it seemed like such a profitable enterprise that Pennsylvania and Delaware wanted to join in, and did. And before you knew it, they were calling for all the states to get together and talk this thing out. Let's see if we can't get some common economic ground and form a common market, in a sense. Well, Congress, the Confederation Congress, thought it was a great idea and called a convention to change the what was euphemistically called the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, to form a central government that would gain powers over international trade, interstate commerce, and powers to raise a common defense against a common enemy. And that call laid the seeds for the Constitutional Convention. And at the convention, those who favored a strong central government gained control, and absolutely threw the Articles of Confederation out, just scrapped them, and wrote the Constitution that we know today to form the federal government that we know today.
So money talks.
Indeed.
We're talking with Harlow Giles Unger, and his latest book is Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office, and he's also the author of John Quincy Adams, and a new book coming soon about John Marshall and the Supreme Court. Could things have gone differently? Could Washington, was he in a position to consolidate power and establish a new ruling monarchy? Could he have done that?
Well, he could have during the war. He was commander-in-chief, could have seized dictatorial powers over the entire nation and established a military dictatorship. But he didn't want to do that. He did not seek power. He loved running his farm at Mount Vernon and did not seek power. He believed in individual liberty and loved thy neighbor, but leave him alone. And tell him to leave you alone. So this was a new type of existence that was only possible in the farmlands of what was then the United States, or what would become the United States. 95% of people lived on farms. Their farms were almost feudal institutions. They were far from their neighbors. They were self-sufficient. They had their own smithy, their own brick-making kilns, they grew their own food. And they didn't need a government to run, to tell them what to do. They were their own governments on their own farms. They left their neighbors alone. They got together every once in a while at a church, and if there was a common problem, they'd get together to try to solve it as amicably as possible. But there was so much land, and enough for everyone to have as much as they needed without stepping on his neighbor's toes. And by the time the Constitution was signed, they really expected life to go on that way indefinitely. Well, it couldn't. The South, of course, based its economy on slave labor. The North was religiously and morally opposed to slavery. The big states, and this was fought out at the Constitutional Convention, the big states claimed that the big states wanted proportionate representation in the new Congress, where the votes would be cast according to the population of each state. Well, the little states complained that the three biggest states would have enough votes to control all of the votes in Congress and absolutely wipe the little states out, deprive the states of any voice in the new government. They wanted what they had in the Confederation Congress, one vote for each state. Well, the big states now complain, well, one vote for each state, eight states with a population less than that of Virginia would be able to control the fate of the nation. So they reached a compromise and created a bicameral legislature in which a House of Representatives would have representation according to the population of each state, and the Senate would have equal representation for each state, with each state getting two votes. So the Constitution was a compromise that gave nobody everything they wanted and everybody something that they wanted, but the result was a real mess which opened the door to endless crises after the new government was in place and Washington was unanimously elected president. As I say, he began, the only source of revenue for the new government were duties. Well, the shipping season ended by late spring, so by autumn, when the first Congress adjourned, there was no money in the till, and Washington had to go on running the government without money. And he simply had to seize powers that were not granted by the Constitution. He sent his Treasury Secretary to local banks to borrow money. Well, the President doesn't have the right to borrow money. Only Congress has the constitutional right to borrow money, yet he did it. Similarly, the following spring, the Indians, who were considered a foreign nation, foreign nations then, attacked settlers, American settlers in the West. Congress was out of session. The President was not about to stand by and see his fellow citizens slaughtered, so he drafted troops sent them to war without congressional consent, again in violation of the Constitution, because only Congress can raise an army and declare war. Yet Washington seized that power, and in the course of his 8 years, he would seize powers in seven different areas, which in my book I call the seven pillars of executive power that Washington raised, and gave the executive the powers that we now call today the imperial scholars call it the imperial presidency. Madison called it the monarchical presidency, but certainly the executive, president today, has far more powers than were granted to him by the Constitution. And often they use those powers recklessly. Often they use them wisely. Certainly the last two presidents have used powers of executive orders recklessly, ordering American intelligence agencies to spy on Americans, to tap our telephones. This is just reckless behavior. This was a power that Washington seized for the first time. He was the first president to issue a presidential proclamation with the force of law. Well, the president has no powers to write laws. That's why they call Congress a legislature. And Washington was the first to do so. And some presidents, as I say, have used that power wisely. It set the precedent for Abraham Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. On the other hand, Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama have used it recklessly to spy on American people.
But what about, I'm thinking of President Nixon. Has there ever been a president that didn't use those powers?
Oh, no, they all use those powers. Indeed, in the course of our government, since the first Congress has passed about 20,000 laws. In that same period, presidents have issued about 14,000 executive orders with the force of law, all of which are unconstitutional. But as I say, some of them have been issued wisely, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, which is the presidential oath, and other presidents have done so, have used those powers recklessly.
Or both. Or they've done them both. They've used some
or
of them.
Or both, yeah. Mm-hmm. President Washington was the first to call up troops. The Constitution called on the president to enforce laws, but gave him no law enforcement arm. It gave him no way to enforce the law. So when there was a tax protest in western Pennsylvania, the so-called Whiskey Rebellion, he, on his own, sent troops there to put down the rebellion. As it turned out, the rebels had all dispersed, so there was no bloodshed. They found about 20 drunks, which they brought back to the Capitol and tried for treason. 18 were found not guilty, and Washington pardoned the other two, but he insisted on enforcement of the laws. Although he had led similar tax protests against the British, he pointed out that we were not represented in Parliament. We were represented in Congress. Tax laws were the will of the people, and had to be obeyed. And so he used troops to enforce the law for the first time. Again, this was unconstitutional, but it set a precedent for Dwight D. Eisenhower to send troops to Little Rock, Arkansas, to enforce the Supreme Court decisions mandating that black children could go to school with white children.
We're talking with Harlow Giles Unger, and his new book is called Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. So I guess the oath should read, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution if you can figure out some way to do it.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, after having violated the Constitution in this way, when George Washington faced his second term, was he unopposed? Was there an election? Did he have to campaign?
No, he was unopposed, and again, won without opposition. The only president other than James Monroe to win presidential election without opposition. Monroe had no opposition when he ran for a second term. I mentioned that the president here has seized all these powers unconstitutional. Since the writing of the Constitution, the three branches of government have each violated the Constitution almost at will. There's been a struggle, a tug of war between these three branches for more power than the Constitution gave them. A couple of years ago, then Vice President Dick Cheney was asked about this, and he called the Constitution a quaint document. he said so with some cynicism, but there's a great deal of truth to that. Congress has overstepped constitutional bounds hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. 200 laws that Congress wrote were declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, and presidents over the years have vetoed more than 2,500 laws passed by Congress, sometimes for political reasons, granted, but often because the president found those laws to be unconstitutional, and they were. Similarly, the Supreme Court has gone beyond constitutional bounds, often issuing decisions that critics call the equivalent of legislation.
How would the election of 2000 fall into
it? That's a perfect example. The Supreme Court has no jurisdiction over elections. Supreme Court is, under the Constitution, the Supreme Court is an appellate court to judge appeals of court decisions by lower courts and to judge the constitutionality of those of the issues at stake. They have no right to interfere in elections. The first unconstitutional Supreme Court decision was back in the 1830s with the Dred Scott decision, in which the court declared all blacks non-citizens. Nothing in the Constitution gave them the right to do so. Indeed, the very first unconstitutional decision is perhaps the most famous one, issued by John Marshall in 1801. Most people who have studied history will recognize the case Marbury v. Madison. And Marbury v. Madison, this court seized the power of what's called judicial review, the right to review a law of Congress and declare it constitutional or unconstitutional. The Constitution didn't give it that right. That is not the purpose of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was set up to hear appeals of cases in lower courts, not to rule on the constitutionality of laws. Yet it seized the power of judicial review. Congress has never acted to counter it, neither has any president, although Jefferson tried desperately to do so. He failed.
And I guess FDR also, did he not try to? I mean,
he tried to pack the court, as Jefferson did. Jefferson kept, the court was largely Federalist, the opposition members of the opposition party when Jefferson became president. He tried to pack the court with Republicans, which have nothing to do with today's Republicans. It was a Jeffersonian party at the time called Democrat-Republicans. and for short, they were just called Republicans. Jefferson kept packing, kept getting his Congress to expand the court, the number of members of the court, and he kept naming Republicans. Well, once they got on the court, they fell under the spell of Chief Justice John Marshall, who had this uncanny ability. He was a wonderful, wonderful man with this marvelous personality. Everybody adored him, regardless of political party. And he had this uncanny ability to coax anyone to agree with him. And while Jefferson expected all the decisions to go in his favor, they never did. They all sided with John Marshall for 35 years. He was the longest serving Supreme Court Chief Justice in American history.
So far.
Roosevelt tried to do the same thing and largely succeeded. The Supreme Court Chief Justice was not an influential enough man to prevent it.
At that time. Well, your latest book, and we've just kind of scratched the surface of it. I mean, it's such a fascinating book, and every little thing that we talk about, you can expound on and write another book. This one is called Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office, and the author, my guest, Mr. Harlow Giles Unger. Thanks for coming back and talking, and I hope you'll join us again soon.
I certainly hope so. It's an honor to be on your show, and I thank you for inviting me.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time. Come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Harlow Giles Unger. His latest book, Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks. See you next time.